Okay, great. Well, it's a delight to be back with you, truly. And for those that are of you that are, I'll just go ahead and answer it. Yes, I only have one coat, one shirt, and one pair of pants. Just let's be clear on that. That's all I have. And shoes, one pair of shoes. I literally thought about trying to find those little things they put on the uniforms, you know, those things on the shoulders. Because somebody that asked me whether if there was a uniform that I wore to class, you know, Salvation Army or something. I don't know how that works. But it's a delight to be back with you, and we get to talk about some stuff that's delightful. Delightful. We're in our series on the cross, of what happened that day so long ago, and the cataclysmic shocks through time and space in our hearts that produces. And so let's open in a word of prayer as we go to look at this. Father, we come to you amazed that you broke into history, that you did not leave us to wallow around in our ignorance, pooling our opinions and passing them off as religious truth, that you saw our sorry state and our confusion, and sometimes you saw our arrogance, but you saw through that to our need and our pain and our hurt and the damage that we inflict upon one another and ourselves. And you broke into history and you gave us a word of peace of mind and of comfort and of healing and guidance in times of darkness and where there are no signals coming, where we don't know where we're stepping and where we're standing and where the way is. We thank you for the brilliance of the light of your Son and your Word, the constant ministry of your Spirit in our lives, giving us insight, trying to break us out of old habits and old ways of thinking. We pray, Father, that you would serve that agenda today in our lives for the sake of your Son, that we might, by gathering around the cross to discover that love, to see that love that came through those wounds and through those eyes, that we might grow together and demonstrate the love that you have in the Trinity for one another. That we might demonstrate that in our body, our people, and that we could show that there is a place of healing, and it's at the foot of the cross. So we ask that you would honor this time for your Son's sake and guide us through this for his sake. Amen. Okay, we are now, if you remember when we started this, so back 45, 46 years ago, we started this series. And we're going through each one of the images of what happened at the cross. When something as big as God breaking into history and taking on a tent of flesh, tabernacling, and when this God lives a life of humility and service and abuse, taking abuse, and then ends up dying on a Roman execution, which is so contrary to what one might expect of God when he would come to earth, that begs for an explanation. There needs to be some kind of answer for what that is. And the explanation that God gave us, of course, is in the owner's manual to life. One of these, not this particular issue, but this is one of the copies of it. The Bible, and where we have it, it took him thousands of pages to explain enough that we could understand. And we still struggle with this, of course. And some of you struggle even worse because of my teaching at this, of course. And we have gone through it. When God described what happened at the cross for us, he used several different images of that came from everyday life so that we could sit there and say, oh, I know what that means. I see what that is. And there were some 20-odd or 20, 25 that I made a list of, and we started through these, and we're covering these in order of mentions. What is it talked about most in the Bible, in the New Testament? And the first one that we covered last year, was sacrifice. Sacrifice was the big one, okay? And it is equal and this is important, it is equal in mentions to the one that we start today called redemption. And there's a very beautiful reason that is the case. In sacrifice, the basic problem that we had was of estrangement. The basic problem was that left to ourselves, we would move away from other people. That if you didn't sort of work at things, if you didn't maintain lines of communication, if you didn't maintain loyalty, you drift apart. If you don't build shared life, community life, you move away. If you don't spend time with God, it looks like He grows distant. And it ain't Him that's moving in it, because He's omnipresent. You can't move real far if you're omnipresent. Okay? But we can move considerably distance from that. And so the issue in that was that of estrangement and health and growth. This one is completely different from that. This is not an estrangement issue. This is a we're in trouble. We're being violated at some level. Some of it's self-violation. There's an element of harm that's different here. That's more in the category of deliberate, and there are willful elements of this that need help badly. And it is when we move into redemption that we come into a strange world, because we don't use the word redeem much, you know, in 20th century Western world. We redeem lottery tickets for the prize. I've not had that experience personally, but I hear that this occurs, right? I hear that this occurs. We redeem green stamps. See, we don't have that notion. But it was a very common economic term back in the periods that we're going to study. And so we're going to have to find out what those words meant before we come to the foot of the cross and said He redeemed us. We were bought with a price, as it says. You are not your own. So we're going to dive into it, and as the way we customarily do this, we're going to scour through all of history, you know, before we get to this stuff. And so we've got this syllabus is on the Old Testament redemption. Because we've got the same problem in the New Testament with redemption that we had with sacrifice. When John the Baptist said, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world," he used the sacrifice image. Remember, we looked at what a Roman soldier would think of that. A Greek, a Jewish Greek, right? A Palestinian Jew. We went through each one of these as to how they would understand sacrifice. And when we get to the New Testament, we're going to have a similar issue, although it divides neatly into two categories, Jewish and Roman. Okay. In the Old Testament, it's a little broader concept that the Jew is going to bring to this message. And that's where we're going to start, is with the Old Testament. Okay. So if you'll start at the syllabus, I'm on page 1. Okay, page 1 at the top. And the introduction deals with four specific structures that redemption looks like it's aimed at, its targets are, when we get all the way through this. The first one there is called the reality of oppression. We do this to one another. History is pretty fairly obvious about that. We are also oppressed by malignant supernatural entities, evil spirits, they're called in the Bible. I call them malignant intelligences. They are maleficent. They are relatively bright and resourceful. They are kept in check only by our good God. We have no idea half the time of what's going on in that arena, and it's probably to our mental health that we do not. If we knew some of those elements, I believe that we would be so afraid of just living and loving that we would not take any steps. I think that God hides part of that world from us deliberately so that He gives us a fair shot at dealing with the challenges of just loving one another, which is difficult enough in itself. But there is a reality element of oppression in our world, in our lives. We do this, and they're big ones, and then there are the ones that are everywhere. We do this to one another. Verbal abuse, acts of reverse kindness, I call them. Those are common in our relationships. They're common in our world. They are the massive ones that we're aware of, subjugation, slavery, Western slavery, genocide. There are big ones that show up in the categories of horrendous evil. But it is pervasive in our own lives, in our own lives. The second one is the reality of what I call the consequence engine. God has built us a world that's predictable so that we can live in. We can make plans, we can count on dropping something and it falling to the floor. We can count on friction when I try to walk. I don't have to wonder whether my foot's going to stick to the floor to launch my overweight condition into the future. I don't have to worry about that. There's a predictability, which means that causes have effect, and there are consequences of actions. So if I do an act of oppression, there are consequences that ripple through history. If I do an act of kindness, there are consequences that ripple through history. And this is the way God has built this, so that I can get up every morning and count on this thing to work. So the consequence engine says that if I sow something, I get a crop, for good or ill. If I sow, something gets reaped. And there's an engine there that's for good or ill. You can see that it was designed for good, because you were supposed to grow crops. We were originally gardeners of some type, or orchard keepers probably. And it was supposed to be this bountiful thing. The thing is, we discovered the opposite, that if you loaded that gun with the wrong kind of stuff, you could do massive damage. You could really hurt somebody when you weren't feeling good with a good word in the morning. We learned that those things could ripple through. And so there's a consequence engine that sometimes we need, if we could, to get it cut off. Just, you know, the old, you know, people that sow wild oats and then pray for a crop failure, right? You know, we would like to accidentally, you know, at some point we'd love to be able to, when we make mistakes, say, can you stop this process, God? Help. I messed up. I messed up here, and damage is starting to ripple through the universe. So we've got a reality of a consequence engine that we need help with for those times that we load this wrong. The reality of voluntary slavery. Now, voluntary slavery is what we'll look at in the Old Testament. Voluntary is where I sell myself into it. This is where I've got myself in the Old Testament, I got myself in such debt through, you know, improper use of funds and mismanagement of my life and profligate living that I can't make ends meet, and I have to sell myself into indentured servitude. And a voluntary, and I can't get out unless I get real profitable as in that job and buy my freedom and be able to go home. I have to live in somebody else's house and these kinds of things. And sometimes it's a voluntary slavery where I just messed up my life so bad I got to do it, you know, to make ends meet. But sometimes it's what Hebrews would call the pleasures of sin for a season, where you sit there and say, something's not working and I've got to escape. I'm going to sell myself to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, because it looks like the payback is better over there than what I'm experiencing in my useless spiritual life when it's broken or something of that type. And so there's a reality of voluntary slavery, that once we get in that situation, and like the prodigal son, we wake up and think, gosh, I had it a whole lot better on the other side. What? How did I get here? And some of us do this like every other day. We wake up in the morning and say, Lord, how did I get here again in this situation that whatever we're in? And then there's the fourth one, the reality of alienation. One of the things that's very, very real in our world is a sense of loneliness, a sense of alienation, estrangement. We wonder where we fit, if we fit. And that's not just an adolescent phenomena. That grows through our entire lives. In the midst of healthy relationships, we can sit there and say, do I really even know this person? You know, do I really fit? I mean, there's a sense of alienation. I'm not home. I'm not at home. I'm a stranger in a strange land. These are four structures, big structures. If you think about these four, they hit us. This is where, you know, we live. We are in and out of all four of these at any given moment. You know, and they multiplex on us, so to speak, as well. And it is those elements that redemption was to address. And you can see this is slightly different than just pure drifting away or estrangement or something of this. There's an element of violence involved in some of these, an element of poor choices, really bad ones, that God has provided in this second major theme. Now, redemption, like I say, the word is so odd that we've got to go back and, like I say, look at what the context was. And so I've got redemption in the ancient Near East. And so I've got a couple of quotes from law codes. And these are from outside the Bible. These would be the context in which the Bible occurred. Okay, and these would be passages from other laws. So these would be laws of Hammurabi. That was a little bit before Moses. And there'd be laws from the Middle Assyrian law codes that are about the time of David. And, you know, and these are just comparative to see how the word redemption was used in the background. The first one I've got there is from Hammurabi. If there is either a soldier or a fisherman taken captive while on a royal campaign, notice apparently fishermen could be serving the king when they did that. That perhaps a job as opposed to just recreation. A soldier fisherman was taken captive. You could be captured as a fisherman. A merchant redeems him and helps him get back to his city. If there are sufficient means in his own estate for the redeeming, he shall redeem himself. If there are not sufficient means in his estate to redeem him, he shall be redeemed by his city's temple. If there are not sufficient means in his city's temple to redeem him, the palace shall redeem him. But his field, orchard, or house will not be given for his redemption. Okay, the scenario is a soldier is away from home, or a fisherman is away from home on duties of the king, and they're captured. This was the major source of slaves in the ancient world, was military capture. Okay, by far and away. We don't get what we had in Western civilization, Western slavery, that most of us are familiar with, until Rome. Slavery, what we will use the term slave in the old ancient Near East, but this was much more like indentured servitude. This was, you did have captured stuff, but they have like seven classes and you could buy your way out. There was a whole bunch of different things. It wasn't nearly as oppressive as the stuff we'll get in the New Testament when we get into the Roman slavery period that fed Western civilization, the U.S. and the Brazilian slave trades and things of this type. So, but in the old ancient world, it's slightly different. And so it was very common if you were captured, a merchant in that city. So I'm traveling from San Jose and I'm visiting Baltimore. And Baltimore has captured a San Jose fisher person, okay, out there and has enslaved them. And if I'm there just traveling through the city, I shell out the cash and buy their freedom. I take them. They now belong to me as the merchant. I come back to San Jose, and according to this, the household of that person was supposed to pay me for that redemption. See, they were supposed to buy that person back, and so I was sort of like just a carrier, brought them back. And if they didn't have enough money, the local religious temple was supposed to pay for them, if they're on official king's business. If they didn't have enough money in the religious temple, the church, then it went to the palace. And it went to the palace. The king will do it. And if you'll notice there in italics, I've got rescue from involuntary captivity or slavery by payment of a price. So redemption meant in that context, rescue. So you were being rescued from involuntary. I didn't want to be there in this case. I got captured and I was trapped. Okay, and the way out was somebody paid my ticket out. Okay, so that was the first. That was a common background. The next one is a little bit later, same time, Hammurabi. If an obligation is outstanding against a man, in which he owes money, and he therefore sells his slave woman who has borne him children. Okay, so this is a servant, sort of like a concubine in those terms. The owner of the slave woman will weigh and deliver the silver, which is the debt, which the merchant weighed and delivered to him as the loan, and he shall redeem his slave woman. So here it is. I borrowed money. I couldn't pay. I gave somebody in my household to be a servant over there to work it off. Once I got the amount of money, I go back and I pay it back, and I get my servant back. Okay. So the case there is recovery of confiscated property, because that was considered property because it's being traded for a debt in this particular case. In this case, the property is labor hours of the servant, basically, because you get the servant back. Recovery of confiscated property due to debt. I'm in trouble, and my property was confiscated, foreclosed, kind of thing. And recovery is by a price, payment of a price. Okay, next one is roughly the time of David. If a man's wife, now the Middle Assyrians, the Assyrians were particularly brutal, as we will notice in this. If you remember in the Old Testament, the Assyrians were the ones who captured the northern kingdom. And they were famous for their brutality. And you'll see this in their law codes very briefly here. If a man's wife should steal something with a value greater than 30 shekels of lead, I could not find out to my life how much that was worth, whether that's a bag of circus peanuts or a Mercedes, okay, steal something greater with a value greater than 300 shekels of lead from the house of another man, if her husband is in agreement, he shall hand over the stolen goods and shall bring ransom her. In other words, they do the swap. He shall cut off her ears. Okay, they marked everybody there. I mean, this is not a gender thing, by the way. You know, you did something wrong there. You got marked, as in some cases you did in recent Semitic cultures over there. But here they marked him with the ears. If the husband does not agree to her ransom to buy her back, the owner of the stolen goods shall take her as a servant and shall cut off her nose. Okay, so in this case, rescue from penalty, this case redemption is rescue for penalty of a crime, slavery and mockery, by the payment of a fine. Now notice in this case, this is rescue from something I really did deserve. In other words, I'm guilty in this case. In this case, the person is guilty. And this is rescue from that consequence engine, legitimate consequence engine. See, this is where I got myself in trouble. I stole the stuff, and somebody redeemed me out of this by paying out of their own pocket. Somebody else bore the cost of my crime. Okay? If a man wants to give in marriage his debtor's daughter who is residing in his house as a pledge. All right, let's stop there for a second. Here I am. You owe me money. You're not paying. Your daughter's going to come to work in my house until you can pay me off, and then she can go back. If it doesn't look like you're ever going to come up with the dough, so here's what happened. He shall ask permission of her father, and then he shall give her to a husband. So if you owe me the money, and you're not paying, and I've got your daughter here, I still have to ask permission. I'm going to, quote-unquote, sell her in marriage to pay off the debt. Because remember, when you did marriage, had a lot of financial transactions there, the dowries and bride prices and things of this type. It would be a source of revenue in this, okay, for this man to recover the debt. If her father does not agree, he shall not give her. He still couldn't do it if the father said, no, we're not going to do this. Looks like we're going to be able to come up with the money and do this. If her father is dead, he shall ask permission of one of her brothers, and the latter shall consult with her other brothers. If one brother so desires, he shall declare, I will redeem my sister within the month. If he should not redeem her within 1 month, the creditor, if he so please, shall clear her of encumbrances and shall give her to a husband. Basically, sell the bride. Okay, get the bride price. Rescue from slavery, control due to debt, by payment of that debt. But notice who did this in this case. It was a family member. The brother said, I will redeem her. If the father was not there, the next of kin was the one responsible to redeem this person. Question? Yeah, Middle Assyrian laws. Yeah, Middle Assyrian laws, about 1000 B.C. roughly, time of David roughly. Okay. The next one. If a man who has not yet received his inheritance share, he's still a dependent in a family, takes a life, he kills somebody, they shall hand him over to the next of kin, and literally it's owner of life, shall hand him over to the owner of life. Should the next of kin so choose, he shall kill him. Execute judgment, basically. Or if he chooses to come to an accommodation, then he shall take his inheritance share. All right? So I go out and I kill somebody, okay, and I'm still dependent. I kill somebody, and then the next of kin comes and has the right to execute me, okay? But I can buy my freedom if I can come to terms. If I can come to terms, I can buy my freedom, okay? And that's a kinsman. We'll see parallels to this in the Old Testament, but you can't buy. Because you can see an obvious abuse here for the rich, can't you? See, if you've got money to buy your way out, right, life is simple. You can kill anybody you want, you know, as long as you got enough money. As long as you can come to it, and as they say, every person has their price, and you'd be surprised at what prices were back then. Okay? Rescue, again, from penalty of a crime, legitimate in this case, by payment of a price. Payment of a price. So far, we've seen everything has been a price involved, a fine or a price or something of this type. And the last one before we get to the Old Testament, if either a man or a woman enters another man's house and kills, we've got another case of capital crime. They shall hand over the manslayers to the head of the household. They turn them over to that family. If he so chooses to come to an accommodation, he will take their property. Okay? And if there's nothing of value to give from the house of the manslayers, either a son or a daughter as a servant. Okay? So in that case, redemption, when you'd go back there, would be rescue from penalty of a crime, death, by payment of a price for a fine. Okay. In all of these, if you see, there's an element of rescue that's associated with it. Okay. Now, the concept when we get the Old Testament is a little broader than that. But in some of these, it was voluntary. I mean, I did something wrong. I did something seriously wrong. I killed someone. And there was a case where someone that was in my family or that was related to me could get me out of that by paying a price or offering a substitute in my place, something of that type. Okay, that's the context of the background that we've got going into the Old Testament, roughly that goes around the laws. When we get to the Old Testament on page 2, we have two words for redemption in Hebrew in the Old Testament. The first is Gaal. Goel, you hear this occasionally, the Goel Redeemer, and we'll use that phrase. And the second is Pada. Now, Gaal, redemption, strictly based on Goel kinship, is not found anywhere else in the ancient Near East. This word, we have no idea where this word come from. Matter of fact, it's a good idea to get any current opinions from Dr. Walkie when he comes in here. If you come to Keck to see if anything new has come about, because I can't find it anywhere in any of my sources, even the ones that he wrote. Okay, so maybe there's some new data you want to ask him on this. Okay, we have some of the concepts we've already seen that about next of kin, owner of life, but the word doesn't show up anywhere. Okay, and it basically has an element of loyalty into it that's a little bit different than the next word. The next word, pada, is just the general word for redemption. It's generally rescuing or redeeming. It's sometimes weakened to just deliver somebody from something. Generally, it involves a price. Redeeming means buying, paying with a price. But occasionally it's softened down to just deliver, rescuing or something of this type. And it's found in all the ancient Near Eastern languages, with the possible exception of Aramaic. So it's the common word. So these words that we would have seen would have been pada. But goel, or gael, is different in that it's based upon family, relationship. So if you see the quote there I've got, to do the part of the kinsman, and thus to redeem his kin from difficulty or danger. What we'll see is that this has to do with a pre-existing relationship that's already there, family. Okay. Now, the next section is where we're going to look at where redemption showed up in the Old Testament. You see we've got, some seven major categories of where redemption applied in the Old Testament. What kinds of things could be redeemed? Those abbreviations you find on the website, those are all my theological word book of the Old Testament by Archer and Walkie. He's one of the sources. So when I've got the little brackets there, those abbreviations, you go to the Christian Think Tank up at the top, and then the book abbreviations, that gives you the page number references if you want to look through it further. Okay, and this is, of course, posted on the web as well. So we're going to have a category of what all could be redeemed. What could get in trouble that you could redeem? And the first one category here is land and houses. Okay, land and houses. Physical property such as land and houses could also be reclaimed through monetary payment. You could buy it back. Buy it back. The Israelites were considered tenants on God's land with the right to produce on that land. Therefore, transfer of property always reverted to the original tenant or his heirs at the Jubilee. Remember, every so often, they would free you your debts. And every so often, if I had to sell my property because I got in financial trouble and I sold my land and my house and stuff like this, it could only stay in that other person's hand for so long because it didn't belong to either me or them. It was originally God's, and God just, we were tenants. At some point, it would revert back to me, and I would be able to come home. I would be able to go back, and my land would return to its rightful owner and where it belonged, where it was comfortable, and where it sat. And that was where it was supposed to come back. So it would revert to the original tenant. If an impoverished Israelite, termed brother in Leviticus 25, was forced to sell his land to raise cash, his near redeemer, the kinsman, was supposed to redeem it. All right. Now that meant if I was trying to sell my old car, under this law, my little brother would have to buy it first. Okay, they'd have the first right to do it, and at some level, to keep it in the family, assuming you would want that car in the family, they would be at some level obligated to do it if they could. If they couldn't, they'd let it pass to the next closest at home. Okay? So the right of lands and houses, because God was trying to keep it in the clan, trying to keep it within the family, okay, so that he wouldn't break up community. He's trying to keep us together here and trying to set the Israelites to where those relationships could grow and develop. So he wasn't trying to scatter everybody and have them move with a job change every 3 years. If the Israelite did not have a redeemer, but had subsequently gained enough wealth, then he himself could redeem it. So I sell my land for cash, I take my money, I invest it in some particularly good internet stocks, and I get profitable there, I can go back and buy my old land back and my old car back. Okay? And so even if nobody in my family bought it, and I did have to sell it to a stranger, fellow Israelite, somebody in another tribe or something like this, I could go back and redeem that. I had the right to do that. Okay? Otherwise, the land would automatically come back to me in the Jubilee year. By that time, I may have died. Okay, so if I wanted earlier than that, again, I'd need to go redeem it. In contrast, in Babylonia, that it says that a man only had the right to redeem his house when the purchaser wanted to sell it. See, that's different. This gave the option, this gave the power to me as the original owner. I could go back, and the seller had to sell to me that property back. It had to revert back to me. Whereas in Babylonia times, I couldn't necessarily get it back always. But here in Israelite law, God says, no, I want it to revert back to the family. I want you to live together. I want you to have extended families and community. It is interesting that if a person was defrauded and then died, the criminal would be required to pay the guilt penalty to the goel, the kinsman, of the deceased. If there were no redeemer, then the penalty would be paid to the sanctuary. Now, what this meant was, we studied this in sacrifice briefly. But if I wronged you, okay, and God finally calls me on the carpet for this, and I get my heart straight, and I said, okay, I got to go make it back up. I stole your sheep, and I got to pay you back the sheep. Okay, I got to make it up. That's that guilt offering thing we looked at, plus a little percentage there. If I go back and do that to you, if in the meantime you have died, and there's nobody to do that to, I pay that back to the nearest brother, or sister, or mother, father, whatever. And if there's nobody in the clan left, I send it then to the church. Okay, but you see, there was a right there that stayed in the family. See, it was a kinsman. It was a blood thing. It was a blood thing. And so lands and houses, like I say, they were supposed to revert back. Improperly taken property, if I took your sheep, it's not my sheep. It's your sheep. And I have to return that to the family. The second category was of indentured things that could be bought back were indentured servants. Also, persons could be rescued from servitude by monetary payment. An impoverished Israelite, again brother, who was forced to sell himself into indentured servitude to a resident alien had the same rights of redemption as existed with relationship to land. Indentured servitude was not slavery. The resident alien was not allowed to oppress the indentured Israelite at all. Israelites could not serve in perpetuity since they were ultimately God's servants whom he had removed from Egypt. These verses indicate that the obligation of a redeemer devolved upon the nearest relative. So if I got really, really poor and I decided that I was going to have to become an in-house maid, basically that's what we're talking about. I'm going to go live on somebody's estate and be the gardener. Okay, I'm going to be a hired hand on the estate, and they're going to feed me and they're going to clothe me as part of the help. Okay, in exchange for room and board, I'm going to work the gardens and stuff like that. Whatever the task that I had skills for to do. Okay, under Israelite law, I could do that only for 7 years. Remember, I only had 6 years of that. In the seventh year, I had to go free. Okay, the reason redemption. So when God pulls the Israelites out of Egypt, the first command he gives them, other than don't step in the tent or you're going to die outside of the mountain, is that you will not take slaves. I brought you out of the first command. You look it up. The first command. He said, you remember what it was like and you treat people like that. You remember what that was like. And so when he puts the laws in here, he makes dead sure that he puts boundaries around all of this. He's very concerned about it. So when he sets up these limitations and these restrictions, he makes sure that there is a cutoff point. 6 years, boom. And when you send them out, you have a party for them, and you send them out with the best of your flocks. He's going to try to deal with this from the ground up. So when I saw, if I got in trouble and I sold myself to a resident alien, because remember, non-Jews could live among the Jews. Remember, if I sold myself to a resident alien, then my brothers or sisters could come buy me my freedom. They'd just pay the price. And the price was roughly the labor that I would do for the rest of the period, roughly. That's what it was. And then I'd go back and I'd be free again. Okay. It could be, like I say, slavery was different back then. I could acquire possessions as a servant, as an indentured servant. I could get rich myself and buy my own freedom by the same amount of money. Okay. So if I got in trouble, if I messed up my life and I sold myself into voluntary servitude, okay, redemption or rescue is being brought out of that, being rescued out of that. Oh, thanks. Okay. Okay, cultic offerings, 3. A cultic offering could be reclaimed by substituting a monetary payment. The offering of an unclean animal, a house, a field, and a tithe of land was redeemable by the owner at full monetary value plus 20%. Somebody actually asked me a question here that I should answer. The word gael, as you'll see it in the syllabus, has an apostrophe between the two A's. There is a proper name in the Old Testament called Gael, G-A-A-L, which is not what we're talking about. So we're not talking, when I talk about the Gael Redeemer, I'm not talking about that one guy in Jewish history. Okay, I'm talking about a different word with the Aleph sign in the middle. Okay, good question. Okay, cultic offerings means that when I went and offered up to the sanctuary one of my flocks, an unclean animal, I could offer my house to the priesthood, I could offer a field to the priesthood or a tithe of land, I could go back and buy that back. So once I offered that to the, and this was, by the way, you do it when you would dedicate a child, not like we have here, you bought it back. Now, if some of you want to leave them here, I understand it. That's not the kind of thing we're talking about here. When you would dedicate a land and you would, quote unquote, give it to the Lord, okay, it was for the Levites to use, or you could buy it back, and that money then would be put in their missionary fund or their offering funds or things of this type. So when you redeemed something that you had given to Yahweh, you just exchanged it for money, which had another level of liquidity that the priest could use. Okay, it is something like when Hannah gave Samuel. Remember, she gave him to the Lord. And Hannah had the child, the little son. She said, "I give him to the Lord all the days of his life." Right? That meant he went and worked there for Eli. That's basically what it meant. He was now a worker there in the priesthood. And it is in that context that I could, quote-unquote, in some cases, buy houses back that were in their possession or animals that were given to them or something of this type. 4, the firstborn. In commemoration of the 10th plague, all firstborn were sanctified, which means set apart, subject to being sacrificed to God. However, under prescribed circumstances, substitutions could be made. Firstborn asses, as unclean animals, were to be redeemed, pada, by sheep, which were clean. But the firstborn of clean animals could not be bought back. At the age of 1 month, all firstborn male Israelites were to be redeemed, bought back, by 5 shekels, apparently by the father. Okay. Now, if you remember in the Egyptian story of the Exodus, we have... right around the time of Moses, Pharaoh decides to stop Israel and does an infanticide pogrom. He goes out there and he kills all the male children. He tells the midwives, kill them, throw them in a river, kill all the male, first, kill all the male children. When it comes time for the 10th plague, says, you reap what you sow. He says, I will kill the firstborn males of everybody in Egypt. And the only way to escape this is to recognize who I am and do this blood thing on the doorpost. And so we presume, by the way, from that a number of Egyptian people did that as well. Because when they leave, there's a mixed multitude, and they are resident aliens that live all among them through all their history. So some of them got the message from the other earlier plagues. And so when God does things at a level of judicial fairness, he literally claimed all of the firstborn, including the Israelites. But he said, I will take a postponement payment from anybody that does this Passover lamb. I will postpone that judgment on them. They are mine, but I will postpone, but I will deal with them once it's mine. I can either kill them, grow them, Turn them into frogs. I can do whatever I want to once it's mine. Okay? And the ones that do this, I will spare their life, but they're all still mine. It's a unilateral type of judgment that I put upon Egypt. When they come out, God says, okay, now we've got to square up here. We've got to sort of square up here. They're mine, and here's what's going to happen. The males, the firstborn males, because the plague was only on the males, the firstborn males, you have to buy at 1 month with 5 shekels. Okay? The animals that are unclean, you will kill them. Okay? And that'll be a perpetual reminder. You break their necks, not just suffer, let them suffer. It's just a quick thing. The clean, but you can even redeem those. See, you can redeem those, and you can buy those and use those yourself. So if I had a donkey that was the firstborn and it belonged to God, I could buy that back if I needed a donkey to pull my cart. If I needed that more than I needed the sheep to make wool, then I would make a substitution. And God said, I've got that flexibility here for you. Okay? So some of these you could do, but the firstborn was a very common statement. Every time you had a newborn, there was a reminder that God redeemed me from Egypt, and it cost something. It cost something. Yes, sir?
What's the significance of the unclean animal
as a
distinction?
Only that what could be sacrificed or not. There's not a lot other than that. I mean, there were... he only set apart... The clean animals were the ones that had more economic significance. So like when we were talking about in sacrifice, when I had to bring a sheep, that most of my income was dependent upon, it meant something. I had to recognize that whatever I did wrong actually hurt. In other words, it cost me something in that. So that's the main distinction between the two. The fifth category is the wife of a deceased relative. In an incident with similarities to the law of levirate marriage and related to the redemption of the land, the book of Ruth assumes that a near kinsman redeemer was supposed to raise up the name of the deceased upon his property by legally acquiring the wife of the deceased, and siring children would inherit the property of the deceased. So we have a mixture of two laws. We have levirate marriage. So in ancient law, because you're trying to keep all of the family estate within the family as it grows and grows and grows, if my brother passed away, under Jewish law, I would have to marry, in a polygamous context basically, his widow, and attempt to sire children if they didn't already have a descendant, and attempt to sire children for that name to continue in Israel, for that name to continue and inheritance to pass down that line. Okay, I had an obligation to do this. It was also a measure of social relief because I now was the benefactor of that family, whoever that family was. I had to literally bring them into my home and take care of them. And so in the book of Ruth, at the end of Ruth, where they go to do this ceremony, he says, you're the closest kinsman. He said, well, I can't do it without jeopardizing my inheritance. I don't have enough money to pick up another family to do this. The levirate thing was also associated with the property. So the point here was that the book of Ruth, which we'll look at as we get into a little further, there we had the widow, Naomi, and she had the daughter-in-law, Ruth, and they had the property of her deceased husband. And in this case, the Goel law, the Redeemer law, said that I'm the first cousin, okay, that I had sort of an obligation to buy that land. But in that, I bought, of course, the servant, Ruth, and because Ruth was related via marriage to Naomi, I got both the levirate responsibility and the property at the same time. And so those two laws work together in some cases to try to maintain family continuity within Israel so there'd be fewer and fewer displaced peoples. So the wife of a deceased rebel is a sort of special case. Six, the owner of a goring ox. Goring means, you know, with the horns, that kind of thing. I can't do the sound effects real well, but next time I'll bring a cassette up for that and we'll get a more realistic ancient Near Eastern ox, if I can find one. When an ox with a reputation for goring killed a person, its owner was subject to the death penalty. In other words, if I've got an ox that just goes out there and just kills people all day long, and I don't deal with this issue, guess who's responsible? Right, okay. Makes sense. However, the owner was permitted to redeem himself from the death penalty if a ransom kefer is laid upon him to be given to the deceased next of kin. This law may be related to the blood redeemer below. All right, so this is a situation where if I'm an ox owner, the first time an ox kills somebody, okay, I'm not subject to as the owner. I'm not really subject to a death penalty. Not, you know, how would I know about the ox? If it happens once and then it happens again, I'm subject to the death penalty. And it's generally going to be executed by that family, because well, they didn't have a professional execution squad, you know, or those kinds of things in ancient Israel, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But if I can somehow make a case that it wasn't really, you know, I did due diligence, I had all these cables around this thing, and, you know, they could sometimes settle for money instead of me being, and it was at their discretion, it wasn't me being able to buy them off per se, okay, but I had no option in later cases. So the first case, I didn't have that as an option, but I wasn't under the death penalty. In the case of this, under certain circumstances, if I could make a case, it would be okay. But I would be redeeming myself in that case with my money from the penalties that I accrued in this case. And then this category, the blood redeemer. Now, this is one of the stranger ones that we won't deal with. We'll talk about it here, but we won't come back to it a lot. There are some elements. We will talk about this a couple of times in other topics around the cross. But the blood redeemer is a special case. And I've got some extra material on this here. So the blood redeemer, Goel Hadam, was the closest male relative of a murdered person. Okay, as is indicated by the stories of Gideon's killing of his brothers, Joab's killing of Abner, Absalom's killing of Amnon, his sister's rapist. The case of Absalom is important since it's illustrated broadened parameters of the blood redeemer, who avenged not just murder, but severe harm, in this case rape, inflicted upon a close relative. And let me make a comment about that. There are different kinds of penalties in the law given for sexual abuse. And they are generally in favor of the woman, unlike generally Assyrian laws. If in most of Assyrian laws, if a man violated a woman, the woman would be killed. And sometimes the man would be killed also, but always the woman was killed. In Israelite code, God gives the benefit of the doubt to the woman. If they're out in the field and there's nobody to help them, okay, only the man dies, because it is presumed that the woman would cry out for help. God gives the benefit of the doubt to the woman, as opposed to what humans do in other governments. And so in the case of rape, we don't have a whole lot of specific instructions, but we have a specific case where we saw that the Goel Redeemer, that specifically talked about for murder, also applied to acts of violent crimes like this. So there was a very definite institution on the part of God to try to minimize acts of such violence in Israel. So it was the closest kin. In the case of homicide, the victim's blood redeemer was responsible for putting to death the person who had committed premeditated murder. The murderer was handed over to the blood redeemer by the elders of his city. The accidental murderer found safety in the designated cities of refuge. In contrast, the Middle Assyrian laws proclaimed that the owner of the life, parallel to the blood redeemer, could take compensation in lieu of execution. Now, if you remember, well, let me read the other quotes and then we'll summarize this thing. If a relative is murdered, the Goel Hadam, the kinsman of avenger of blood, usually the son of the deceased, has the duty to kill the murderer or a member of the latter's clan. In essence, this redeems the blood of the dead clansman, that is, restores the clan's equilibrium and wholeness disrupted by the murder. And if you remember that from Genesis, where Cain killed Abel, he said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground." There's that element that's consistent from Genesis to Revelation, that the blood of those that are violently killed and cry out for equilibrium, for fairness, for retribution, for balance back, uphold our integrity in this particular case. Second quote there, the avenger of blood is a relative of the slain who will take it on himself to protect the family rights, to avenge his relatives of the loss suffered by the family. In fact, the term goel, often translated redeemer, has this basic idea. The goel is principally the protector of family rights. We will come back to that. Protector of family rights. A redeemer is one who redeems the loss sustained by the family. This can be done by payment of a price. It may also be in the taking of life. In the latter case, one is the avenger of blood. In his, now this is important about due process. I remember 25 years ago, or plus, first time I read the passage about the kinsman redeemer, I got the impression that the kinsman redeemer sat there and saw this murder and instantly just struck him down. Just boom. Lost. I mean, they were equally as vengeful and wrathful and, you know, really quick instead of the process that actually is laid out, which we're going to see right here. In his rage against the loss of a family member, the Goel Hadam might rashly kill the offender before he found out the circumstances of the death. If the death was not premeditated, it was quite accidental, then the killing of the offending party would add wrong to wrong. Right? If it was an accident, you don't want to do judgment on, there's no capital thing for an accident. Basically then, the provision of the cities of asylum was another instance of the mercy of the Lord and His provisions for the needs of His people in the world setting in which they lived. And which, let's say I'm out there, I'm slaving away as a consultant. Okay? An axe head, I'm doing wood consulting, an axe head slides off the thing and kills my fellow consultant. Okay? In that particular scenario, what happens? Well, I'm going to run. Because who's going to know that that was accidental until we get a chance to do some kind of trial thing? Right? So I go to what they call the cities of refuge. Remember those cities of asylum? That was a place I could run. I could run to and appeal to the elders of the city, so this was an accident. Give me asylum until we can work through this process. Okay, so the avenger of blood could cut the person that was in charge of doing capital executions could go to the city, but he couldn't get me. It was like home base. I was okay until I came before the judges. But justice would be served eventually. And then this last quote, and then I got to let you go. While the biblical law clearly indicates the responsibility of the blood avenger to avenge the death of a kinsman, this practice of blood feud could be disruptive to the administration of judgment. And thus, the six cities of refuge were established to provide a cooling-off phase as well as due process for the accused. Remember, two witnesses were necessary to convict. Notice, by the way, you had to have two or three eyewitnesses to have anything like capital punishment. We would not have, in ancient Israel, an OJ scenario. See? Because there were no two full-blooded eyewitnesses right there. And so capital punishment was not subject to some of the perhaps abuses that we have in other systems, because the stringent requirements here made sure that there was no possibility of an innocent victim getting run over by the system per se. Or it was so minimal, let's put it that way. Two witnesses were necessary to convict, and then it became the responsibility of the blood avenger to execute the felon. No ransom for the convicted murder was possible. This contrasts with laws formulated elsewhere, which we've already pointed out. Okay, I'm going to save that last quote for later, that last section, because we're going to talk about how this extended to the oppressed next week as we get into the next section. But if you look back over what we've talked about so far, you can see some broad structures of redemption occurring. Redemption is getting us out of some trouble. Getting us so far, what we've seen, getting us out of some hot water that we've either gotten ourselves into or somebody has captured us. In other words, we're either, somebody is out after us, we have an actual enemy. Sometimes the enemy is us, sometimes it's them. And it's in those situations that the Redeemer, that the rescue would occur, but it always, so far, involved payment. Some cost somewhere in the system. So we'll come back next week and we'll start looking at that next category called God as Redeemer. So let's close in a quick prayer. Father, we thank you so much for your love. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the beauty of your laws in the ancient world. We thank you for your care for people, where you try to set up systems in which you rescue us. You try to provide structures within Old Testament law so that we could experience wholeness and home and family and community. We just pray that you would help us work on those areas in our lives as well this week, as we would start to experience more and we see that your heart beats for that and that you have provided some means for us to experience that freedom in those relationships. Bring us back safely together next week as we study more and more about what rescue meant to you and your heart. For your son's sake, we pray. Amen.